Israel has bombed and destroyed literally everything necessary to live in Gaza. Wells, farming land, fishing boats, bakeries, churches, mosques. Nothing is there anymore. I've concluded in March this year with others, and there are Israeli scholars, experts of genocide, together with leading genocide scholars, that what Israel has done, there were reasonable grounds to believe that Israel had committed acts of genocide.
That's Francesca Albanese, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Francesca Albanese, Anatomy of a Genocide, Gaza. Francesca Albanese of the UN says, quote, Gaza is now a wasteland of rubble, garbage, and human remains, unquote. And it may be worse than that. In the litany of crimes, genocide is the most heinous. Umar Bartov, Brown University genocide scholar and former Israeli military officer, in November 2023, just a month after the October 7th attack on Israel, said, quote, there is no proof that genocide is taking place in Gaza. By May 2024, he said, quote, I no longer believe that. It was no longer possible to deny that Israel was engaged in systematic war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocidal actions, unquote. He said Israel in Gaza was acting, as the Genocide Convention puts it, quote, with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, inflicting conditions of life meant to bring about the group's destruction. Our guest today is Francesca Albanese, an international lawyer. She's the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories. She's the first woman to hold that position. She spoke at Georgetown University at the end of October. And now, Francesca Albanese, Anatomy of a Genocide, Gaza.
And now let's start. My work and Palestine. For those of you who are not familiar with the work of a UN Special Rapporteur, UN Special Rapporteurs and independent experts are independent experts appointed by the United Nations to document and report on sensitive human rights issues. Most of us, we are either legal practitioners, legal scholars, or a mix of both, who have distinguished themselves for their human rights commitment and capacity to also be human rights defenders in the first place. Well, we have now about 55 of us, and the majority of the independent experts cover thematic mandates, so freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, summary execution, extrajudicial killing, prevention of torture. Then there is a small number that covers country mandates, and this is the situation for my mandate. This has been ongoing for 30 years and mandated to look at the Israel's violations in the occupied Palestinian territory, namely the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip. One of the criticisms that has moved to this mandate is that it's biased, because it only looks at the violations committed by Israel. But certainly so, because when the mandate was created, there was no Palestinian authority. And still, the occupation was 25 years old. So the Palestinians had already been under 25 years of martial rule, with orders, military orders, written by soldiers, enacted by soldiers, implemented by soldiers, and reviewed in military courts by soldiers. The occupied Palestinian territory is the only place where there is something called juvenile military justice, which is a monstrosity in and of itself, because the reality, and the lawyers among you will know, that military courts are not made to try civilians, are not fit for that. And there have been this use of military courts, which is not exceptional in the case of Israel, but has been systematic in the occupied Palestinian territory for now 57 years is completely, profoundly against international law. And again, the reason why there was this creation of the juvenile system is to accommodate the recommendations, including of the United Nations and other observers who were asking the occupying power to be more legit, to behave in line with international law. But after 25, 35, 45 years of occupation, I mean, this is something that I was happy my predecessor raised in 2017, because my predecessor, Professor Michael Link, has been the first one to raise the question, isn't it about the time to declare the Israeli occupation unlawful? Because it quintessentially violates the right of self-determination of the Palestinian people by preventing their existence as a people, free as a people, on the little that remain of their historical land. Because the reason why we talk about the West Bank is Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip, this 22% of land is what remains of historical Palestine prior to the arrival of British colonialism under the guise of an international mandate in Palestine. It was a land inhabited by a majority of Muslim and minorities, Christian and Jewish people who had lived in relative harmony for centuries. And when the state of Israel was created as a response to a horrific, horrific injustice inflicted on the Jewish people with the Holocaust, the culmination of centuries of persecution, but it was a European problem. And the way it was fixed was through colonial means. Particularly Western countries supported the creation of a state for the Jews only in a land that was already inhabited. Now, I cannot say as an individual, I mean, I cannot condemn as an individual what many Jewish people did, took part in, were forced to take part in, because they were rejected even after the Holocaust. Now everyone sympathizes with the Jewish people, but we shouldn't forget the countries like the UK, this country, and Australia push back boats transporting Jewish Holocaust survivors soon after the Holocaust. And many Jewish people understand the enormous attachment and love that many Jewish people have for Israel. I do understand, because Israel has given them a sense of certainty, dignity, security, and protection. But two things. After 75 years, we cannot forget that this came at a huge price for the original inhabitant of that land, the native people in that land. And that injustice has never, not only it has never been fixed, it continues to be denied, but then the injustice has never stopped there. Even the little that remained of that land, which international consensus has established for 32 years now, that should be the state of Palestine, even that has been land considered by Israel free for annexation and conquest. And for 57 years, Israel as a state has facilitated and supported the construction of settlements in the occupied Palestinian territory. Today, there are about 300 settlements, meaning colonies for Jewish Israelis only, on Palestinian land for 800,000 Jewish Israeli citizens. And what I'm going to say is the backbone of the apartheid system that Israel has imposed on the Palestinians. Because while these Israelis who reside on land unlawfully occupied by Israel and expropriated from Palestinians are under civilian law, Israeli civil law, the Palestinians are under military law. And I know some of you might be thinking, oh yeah, but there is the Palestinian authorities. Yes, on the paper. Because the reality is that the Palestinian Authority controls very little. Evidence of it is that since the new Israeli government coalition came on board, came to power at the end of 2022, there has been an acceleration of the de jure annexation of what the West Bank in particular. And in connection with it, the attacks against the Palestinians in the West Bank have increased at the hand of Israeli armed settlers, escorted, supported by Israeli soldiers. Only in 2020, in 2023, during the first month of 2023, there were 12 attacks that Israeli human rights organizations defined called pogroms, a word that is deeply evocative for many, many Jewish people in particular, given what they have endured in Eastern Europe until the last century. And again, the scenes, if you look at the scenes of everything, there is video footage of everything that has been done, unfortunately, most of what has been done. And there was no reaction. So, but only during the 16 months I was special rapporteur before October 7, there had been 460 Palestinians killed. 460 in 16 months, and 60 Israelis. And again, I would like you not to think, because everyone thinks of a conflict and a war, but this is a misnomer, because a war gives you the sense that these are two people or two powers confronting each other, and they're not. The relationship is one between the occupier, an occupier, in fact, an unlawful occupier, because not only Michael Link and scores of human rights experts have said that, but even the International Court of Justice, the supreme organ of the United Nations, the CIR has concluded unequivocally and based on international customary law that the occupation is illegal. Therefore, Israel needs to withdraw the occupation, withdraw its military presence, dismantle the colonies, and stop attempting to annex the land slated to become a Palestinian state, and its resources. And it has also concluded, other than by name, that this is an aggression also marked by racial segregation and apartheid. So, because of this comprehensive unlawfulness, how is it possible that the international community did not intervene? Because over 57 years, there have been mass forced displacement. Not only 1947-49, when 750,000 Palestinians were displaced mainly by modern-day Israel, but also in 1967, when Israel occupied the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip, it kicked out 350,000 Palestinians, very much with the modalities of today, erasing villages, destroying civilian infrastructure. And this is why on October 14, I warned the international community that I saw that it was very possible that under the fog of war, as it had happened already twice in history, Israel would advance the mass forced displacement of Palestinians from their land, or what remain of their land, because in fact, the people in Gaza are not even from Gaza. 75% of them are from the modern day Israel. They still have their lands there. There's no way to say that what happened on October 7 was not, to a large extent, a series of crimes, war crimes at least. Because doesn't matter how the right to resist is recognized to the Palestinians within the limits of the law. The moment civilians are touched, killed, brutalized, or taken hostages, we are in the realm of crimes, and crimes are to be investigated and prosecuted. And of course, there were crimes committed. But the thing is, and actually without but, and the thing is, I was completely taken aback by the reaction of the international community. Because of course, the Israeli society was profoundly shaken, because while the world had grown completely used to see the bodies of the Palestinians, adults and children, slaughtered, their homes reduced to smithereens for decades. There had been five violent military assaults from Israel on Gaza during the previous 15 years, which had caused over 5,000 people killed, including 1,200 children. But this has never registered with us, has it? Because, of course, on October 7, and for months, the only thing we have been talking about was October 7. Majority of us, because others, including many Israelis, with the heaviest start, they were suffering for what they were going through. Many of them lost family members and others, but were saying, we warned you. We warned the world against this. Violence generates violence. And an oppressive occupation like the one we have imposed on the Palestinians sooner or later would have exploded right on our face. This doesn't mean justifying. This doesn't mean condoning, rather the contrary. But we cannot level, we cannot kill reason on just in the interest of political convenience. And we cannot decontextualize and dehistoricize what has happened 12 months ago and ever since. Because in this country in particular, you're not alone. I mean, my country joins the circle and so does Germany and France. Political leaders and most of the mainstream media have continued to recite the mantra of Israel's right, sacrosanct right to defend itself. No question. Israel has the right to protect itself, the territory. It's complicated, but let's say the pre-1967 borders, the security of that and its citizens. But this, Israel continues to confuse that security with the security of its annexation plan and its ambitions to rule and rein in on the occupied Palestinian territory. And international law is very clear that the right of self-defense, which doesn't just mean what is in common parlance, doesn't mean the right to protect oneself. It means the right of the state to use force that is only possible under two circumstances in international law and in line with Article 51 of the UN Charter, when it's authorized by the Security Council or when a state is under attack or severe threat thereof by another state. And it's the jurisprudence of the International Court of Justice, consolidated jurisprudence that was affirmed in 2004 in the case of the occupied Palestinian territory, and it has been reaffirmed nowadays, on this year, in 2004. Israel, there is no question that Israel faces security risks emanating from the occupied Palestinian territory. And the best way to deal with it is to withdraw the occupation and stop oppressing the Palestinians. It's that simple. We cannot claim that Israel's, as this country does, that Israel's right to protect itself translates into the right to oppress another people in perpetuity. This is damaging not just the Palestinians, this is damaging the Israelis themselves. And when the dust settles over what has happened in Gaza, we will see the tragedy that it has been. Not this past 12 months, let's hope no more, have been both for the Palestinians and the Israelis, because they will realize what they have done and it will be hugely traumatic because everything has been documented by the soldiers themselves. The destruction of Gaza is nearly complete. 90% of the people in Gaza have been forcibly displaced up to 10 times. Imagine being forced to leave your home under a rain of bombs, not for one day, for one week, for one month, but for 12 months in a row. Doesn't matter if you are young or old, if you're pregnant or if you're elderly, if you're disabled or if you have medical conditions, you leave and your home gets destroyed behind by a cheering crowd of soldiers who then put the video of your destroyed home, the destruction of whom has been dedicated to a friend or a fiancé, and whatever is not destroyed is violated. There's been a gamification of the violation of the intimacy of the Palestinian belongings left behind, but those fleeing. And, you know, and everything has been targeted, not just military bases, schools, universities. All universities have been leveled to the ground. There is no more university in Gaza. Gaza had the highest number of people with university degrees, and this is not exactly because it was for free in Gaza. No, it's just because people who have lost everything tend to highly value education as the only thing that is nurtured inside themselves and cannot be destroyed other than at the price of taking your life, as it's happening. Entire generations have been wiped out. It's estimated, and it's a conservative estimate, 42,000 people have been killed by bombs and snipers, 17,000 of whom are children. Let that sink in for a moment. I mean, I tell my connationals, if we said, and we are in Italy, the number of Italians is tenfold the number of Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territory. But I said, if I told you that 17 Italian children have been killed, how would you feel? And you see the horror in their face. Because something doesn't register when you say 17,000 Palestinian children. This is testament to the racism that certain people carry. Not to see the other as human starts with this, with the fact that we value life and death according to the nationality or the religious group. And again, Israel has bombed and destroyed literally everything necessary to live in Gaza. Wells, farming land, fishing boats, bakeries, churches, mosques, homes in which people had invested life savings. Nothing is there anymore. UNRWA premises, all UN premises, 70% of them have been either destroyed or severely damaged. And the United Nations have never been attacked as in the past 12 months. Over 200 UN staff people, members were killed, together with 150 journalists and other officials and figures of the United Nations have been attacked as anti-Semites, supporting terrorism, and the list goes on. Look, I've concluded two more things I wanted to share with you before opening for questions and answers. I've concluded in March this year with others, and there are Israeli scholars, experts of genocide, together with leading genocide scholars, that what Israel has done, may amount to acts of genocide. I've concluded in March that there were reasonable grounds to believe that Israel had committed acts of genocide in three respects: causing the killing, the deliberate killing of members of the group, the deliberate infliction of severe bodily of mental or mental harm to members of the group, and creating the conditions that would lead to the destruction of the group in whole or in part. What constitutes genocide? It's established as Article 2 of the Genocide Convention, which says, and this is very specific to this crime, that in order to have genocide, these acts should be committed with the intent to destroy the group in total or in part. And I have concluded, together with other experts, but is it not that ostentatious, the genocidal intent in this case? And it's been said, words are not enough. In order to establish genocide, jurisprudence looks at the opportunity, the capacity, and the practice. Not only it's been said, we will destroy the Gaza, it's a responsible nation, there are not uninvolved civilians, there are no civilians, there are human animals, and we will destroy the Amalek. For me, this is after 1 year of being forced into chronicle the genocide, something that I took on very reluctantly, trust me. This word will stay forever with me and with others as the word that has marked this genocide, because the Amalek might mean nothing to most of us, but it's a biblical exhortation where in the Bible it's said to go and destroy the Amalek, the mother, the suckling, meaning the baby, the camel, the donkey, and everything. And this is what has been done. Netanyahu has evoked, the prime minister has evoked this term, and it has been used through and through, and there are hundreds and hundreds of pieces of evidence stored, collected by various investigators who are working on the case. Probably the most comprehensive collection so far was made available by the South African legal team in their submission, for any who was curious to look at it, to the Security Council earlier this year. And against all this, the International Court of Justice for three times has recognized the plausibility of the risk of being in breach of the risk of, sorry, of being in breach of the provisions protecting the rights of the Palestinians under the Genocide Convention, which means the plausibility that genocides could be committed. Again, I understand that people challenge this, but seriously, let's be logical and beyond semantics. If there is the risk that the rights protected under the Genocide Convention are infringed upon, there is a risk that the crime is being committed. And several recommendations have been made to stop, without even for the court to look at the merits of the case, to stop the conduct that would result in genocide. And they have been violated through and through. And I've concluded in my last report that was made public today, which is called Genocide as Colonial Erasure. And it walks on the heels of that of the report I published in March. In March, I said Israel has not denied to have killed people in safe zones once they had received evacuation orders while they were being ping-ponged and corralled in unsafe areas. It has justified that. It has said that they were terrorists, accomplices. In fact, the way artificial intelligence has been used proves that nothing that was done in Gaza as of October 9, which for many experts studying what's happening marks the beginning of the genocide when the order was given to destroy Gaza. Well, then the situation has escalated in an unprecedented way. And Israel has justified what it has done by distorting the language of international humanitarian law. The last point is that I added to this not only clustering patterns like massacres that have been committed from March until end of September at an intensified pace against a devastated population. Really, when we will see what has been done to the people on Gaza, we will be ashamed that it has happened on our watch. And I say that having been forced to look at a little that has transpired of what they have been enduring, adults and children alike. And it's been also devastating to see young Israelis not seeing what they were doing. So it's been very heavy. And again, it is, as I say in the report, in order, the court cannot miss the forest for the trees, need to look. You cannot look for genocidal intent with a microscope, because genocide is an insidious crime, but it's a collective and complex endeavor. And if you take a step back and look at the totality of conduct against the totality of the people in the totality of the land, and put all these elements together and look at what a state that claims to be a rule of law system with separated powers, you cannot claim that this has been only the act, the atrocities intended by a group of government officials. Because what were the other government officials doing? They have supported, aided, and abetted, and even further enabled what the war cabinet has done. And what was the judiciary doing? Just kept on passing laws to make the treatment of Palestinians harsher. Then what has the judiciary done, especially after January 26, when the International Court of Justice ordered Israel to investigate and prosecute genocidal incitement? Nothing. This is the first settler colonial genocide to ever appear before an international tribunal. and I truly hope that an opportunity to deliver justice to the Palestinians and in a contorted way to the Israelis as well will not be missed, because only by restoring justice there is an opportunity that peace will be brought to that land, and somewhat it will be a recognition that justice is possible also for other indigenous people. Thank you.
You're listening to Francesca Albanese, Anatomy of a Genocide, Gaza. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or go online our website, alternativeradio.org.
Can you speak to the role of media, especially in countries that are supporting the genocide, ethnic cleansing, whatever the legal term is, agreed, and how sort of this domination of the narrative of what's happening is actually helping bring the public opinion support for sort of this cycle of the violence and the support, especially the United States? We know they're funding, supporting, arming, providing diplomatic cover for the attacks, and then also government officials attacking you as a UN official. Thanks.
The role of the media, where to start? Look, I think that this is not new in the sense, if you look at the acts of the criminal proceedings, both in Rwanda and in former Yugoslavia, you will find that the media often play a critical role in genocides, in the sense it amplifies it takes sides. The mainstream media tends to be complacent with the ruling power and become a tool in the hands of the genocidaire. What is really critical here and absolutely shocking is that this is not Israeli media. Actually, we owe much of what we know, for example, on some of the crimes that have been committed to courageous Israeli journalists. And there are many Israelis, not as many as we they should, and as many as we need, but it will change. There are many Israelis who oppose this system, oppose what Israel has been doing as of October 7, and without denying what Israelis have suffered on October 7. But again, they can avoid the contextualization. So, what I've seen the media doing is replicating, giving a platform to the Israeli army, as it was, again, doing, it's what I've called the humanitarian camouflage, justifying the violation of international law, the violation of the principle of distinctions, of proportionality, of military necessity. And again, the Palestinian population has become a population of human shields, when in fact, the human shields that we have seen evidence of were used by the Israeli army. And how do we know that? Thanks to the Israeli media. Again, also the media, but also some politicians, including in these countries, have talked about the beheaded babies. There were no beheaded babies, which doesn't take anything away from the crimes that have been committed on October 7. But why this fascination and this toxic propension to magnify brutality and mass rapes? There were no mass rapes. I mean, there was no evidence of mass rapes. There is a commission of inquiry which was investigated, and we cannot discard that there might have been incidents of rapes, but why? We don't know. But there is clearly no evidence of mass rapes. So the question is, why there is no outrage for what Israeli human rights organizations have reported being networks of torture across Israeli detention centers post-October 7. And this was not, I mean, Palestinians have been systematically abused, often tortured. We know that through Israeli organizations mostly, because the Palestinians were not allowed to get into Israeli prisons. But, and also some Western correspondents, I think it was CNN who entered or accessed some of the witnesses. So, and again, if I had to be very blunt and brutal, I think that our societies have a huge problem with racism that can decline in different forms. Clearly, we have not dealt with real anti-Semitism I hear that. I hear that. It exists. And it's repulsive and it's disgusting. And I say that especially among Western fellows and especially among European fellows, this is something that shall not, should not, must not come back ever because of the history that we have inflicted on this, on these people. At the same time, critiquing the state of Israel is not anti-Semitic. So we should not conflate the two things. There is also another problem that is evident, is the fact that there has been an increasing level of racism against Palestinians. Anti-Palestinian racism goes completely undetected. If half of the things that are said about the Palestinians were said about the Israelis, and most people will be in jail. And the thing is that we need to treat individuals equally as human beings. We cannot be sensitive on language toward one group while being totally abusive toward another. So the media will be dealt with one day, I hope. But we have to be the guardians of some basic principles, because it seems that, I mean, again, I encourage everyone to read Primo Levi, who's a Holocaust survivor from my own country, Italy. And he has written memorable, very accessible, fundamental pages that show the risk of return of fascism when the reason gets dozes off on a sleeping mode.
Thank you. I'd like to hear your response to the Israeli objection to your suggestion that withdrawal from the occupied territories would solve the problem. They would say, we did withdraw from Gaza and look what happened on October 7th.
The withdrawal from Gaza, what happened in 2005 is that the state of Israel, under the leadership of Ariel Sharon, withdrew the colonies, from dismantled the colonies in Gaza, something that has had a huge impact on the radicalization of the settler movement. And again, this there is a lot written by Israeli scholars, scholar Nurit Peled, on this. But the colonies are evidence of colonization, not of military occupation. The military occupation exists when there is effective control of the territory, which in fact remain, because after 2005, not only Israel has maintained maritime access through sea, land and air over Gaza on all borders. It has sealed all borders. It has continued to control the currency, the civil record registry, the telecommunications space, the natural resources. I mean, have you seen how easy it has been for the Palestinians in Gaza to starve after October 9? Because Israel controlled and could turn off water, electricity, and provision of fuel and other means. Plus, one of the two critical elements are that Israel has controlled the caloric intake that an average Gaza was allowed to have. I mean, in Gaza, there were also wealthy people before October 7. So but the majority of the people were living on hands out provided by humanitarian organizations. And because of the violence and the war, 90% of the children before October 7 displayed depression-like syndromes. Let's not even go into what their parents were experiencing. The other critical element is that after 2005, Israel retained unilaterally the right to carry out preventive strikes, meaning to what the Israeli army used to refer to, let's say an awful expression, to mondolon, to attack Gaza. Of course, it was a ghetto. It was a ghetto where and people had no freedom and the violence was extreme. And plus, Hamas, he was born under, also with the support of Israel, to break the secular leadership of Palestine. He was born like a welfare organization, and then he became a political party in response to the Oslo Accords. There is no question that Hamas has committed orchestrated crimes against Israelis. But Hamas would have not become the force it has had not there been that level of oppression and the occupation. Because I was in Gaza, and others have documented it. There were several attempts from the people in Gaza to overthrow Hamas, whose first victims in Gaza were the Palestinians. All those after they won the election and then they were rejected by the international community, there was an internal fight that lasted almost 2 years. And many Palestinians affiliated with the PA, the Fatah, the main opponent, were killed. And so the system pre-October 7 was very convenient to the Israeli government, which has often referred Netanyahu first and foremost, but also other members of his current cabinet, to Hamas as an asset and the Palestinian Authority as a liability. Again, I take your question as referred to by the Israelis, meaning if we withdraw from Gaza, we will have another October 7. This is a very racist thought. It's and we should really question this kind of thought, meaning the people, if they are let free, they will turn into barbarians. And it's like opening the cage. What is it? It's not that the Palestinians are naturally prone to violence. They want to live a normal life like anyone else and don't believe the monstrosities that are told, because they were not true. They are not true about the Palestinians today as much as they were not true about the Jewish people in Europe 80, 90 years ago. Because if you read the acts of proceedings from the Nuremberg and also the Nuremberg trials, you will see that Jewish children were reportedly killed because they were seen as a security threat. So we need to know the past in order to prevent it from returning.
What would an investigation into genocide look like? Who would take the lead? How would the Palestinians be involved? How would Israelis be involved? How would the West be involved? Who would try these people? How would we investigate? Where would they be tried? Where would they be held? Just how would an investigation and justice, what would it look like?
I cannot tell you. I don't want to speculate. I cannot tell you. I cannot elaborate much because I've not been thinking of that. But first of all, this is something that is not different from what has been done with other crimes, war crimes and crimes against humanity. You look at the facts. You look at the facts objectively. You collect the evidence, and then you analyze it against international standards. There is, not extensive jurisprudence on genocide, but there is. I mean, and it's very telling. I mean, I've tried in this last report to give a sense of what is genocidal intent attributable to a state, and so much can be derived and drawn from that jurisprudence. But there are two things that I'm compelled to say, is that there are two types of investigations. And the threshold for the evidentiary threshold cannot be the same. Because first, there is criminal responsibility of individuals. And the genocidaire or alleged perpetrators of genocide can be tried by the International Court of the International Criminal Court, but also other tribunals, because state parties to the Genocide Convention have an obligation to prevent and prosecute and punish the crime of genocide. And so this can be activated. Investigations can be also launched by by domestic courts. And then there is the responsibility of the state that can only be investigated by the International Court of Justice. But again, if we used the evidentiary standards set to ensure fair trial to alleged perpetrators, we would never, and we need to wait for that trial to be over, assuming that one prosecutor initiates such a trial, then there would be impossibility to prevent genocide. The responsibility to prevent genocide arises the moment the risk is there. And that risk was identified on January 26. As of then, the responsibility kicks in, including for states who had the obligation, the legal obligation, not as an act of charity, not to aid and assist a state who could be plausibly commit acts of genocide. And this is why I really hope that this country, with the wonderful lawyers it has, will look into these and try to contribute to the advancement of justice.
since Palestine is not a state in the UN system, how is it able to access laws and resources? And I would add the courts that you were just talking about. So as a non-state actor, what kind of rights do they have?
This is not accurate because it's not true that the state of Palestine is not a state. Under the Montevideo Convention, which is customarily looked at like the criteria to recognize the existence of a state, recognition by other states is not a founding criterion to have a state. A state exists when there is a government over a territory, over a people, which has the capacity to establish contact with the international community. And I think there are 136 states recognizing, more or less, don't take me for granted, I mean, to be checked, who recognize the state of Palestine, which is also a member with observer status at the UN. So it has accessed the main treaties, it has an authority, the Palestinian Authority. The point is that it's a state born in captivity. In 1988, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which was the government in exile of the Palestinian people, voted for the establishment of a state in whatever territory remained, meaning in the 1967 occupied territory. So in 1974, they had renounced the liberation struggle, the idea of taking the land back from the settlers. And in 1974, they formulated a one-state proposal. They said, we can live together, but the refugees need to be allowed to be back. And it was, of course, it never materialized. But even after the Oslo Accords, what should have become the full and sovereign independent state of Palestine has not materialized because the Oslo Accords were never intended to grant independence and sovereignty to the Palestinians. They were an interim step to consolidate control Israeli control over Palestinian land. And so the Oslo Accords have not been a failure for the Israelis. They've been successful, I mean, in further dispossessing the Palestinians. And this is not the first case, because even in this country, I mean, I was reading a book some time ago about how the Native American rights were violated despite treaties signed with them. So there is some precedent to the Oslo Accords. So Palestine, even if it's not fully sovereign and it's considered a state, the point is where it's very hypocritical to be a broker to the two-state solution and not even recognize the state and vote against the state of Palestine, the recognition of the state of Palestine inside the UN. So I said, and the court has confirmed this, enough with the two-state mantra. If it's not premised upon the right of self-determination of the Palestinians, which again means the right to be free, either in the form of a state or with full citizenship rights without discrimination. It must be either or.
How do you explain the lack of action on the Security Council or the UN? And it seems like they're like paralyzed. Whatever decisions they make or agree on is just discarded by the Zionist state of Israel.
Well, the UN, we shouldn't dream. The UN is a reflection of the world order. And this world order was designed and devised in the aftermath, in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. It has evolved from a group of states which are fundamentally colonial powers and some other states which are gaining independence by then. But the majority of the member states who compose today the General Assembly gained independence from the colonial system after the 60s and 70s and through the 80s and some even after that. So some states are even decolonized, have decolonized themselves very, very recently. So the system is not equal. The voting patterns in the UN Security Council reflect that, the fact that there are some states with veto power. And there is no question that there is a clear imbalance and in favor of Western countries. As a Western person, I feel really disappointed because we had, as Western countries, we had the opportunity to really be a model in many ways because of the development we had reached decades ago before turned into extremely destructive and greedy. And we could have used our soft power, but recognizing the injustices of the past. We should have really atoned for what we have done through slavery, through colonialism, and other forms of oppression of native people. We cannot continue without booking our colonial amnesia. Therefore, I think that nowadays it's facing a critical challenge, and it might collapse in its entirety. And I fear that because we will miss human rights when we don't have them anymore. We will miss the UN when we won't have it anymore. And the order that might come next, I don't take it for granted that it will be a better system. Again, I really saw the potential and the value of having political system premised upon freedoms, freedom of expression, freedom of association, and fundamental civil, political, economic, social, and cultural rights. This is the challenge that we have completely missed. This is where we have failed as international, as Western countries, Western societies, and we can still come back. We are suspended, I often say, between the precipice, the abyss, and hope. Hope comes from the Palestinians and the Israelis who resist and can imagine a decolonized future, and from the youth. Frankly, I really praise the many of you who have shown older people what it means to walk the talk when it comes to human rights. So thank you. Thank you very much. And also thank you to the scholars and the faculty members who stood in solidarity, but not in solidarity, with a sense of responsibility with you. Because this is what conscientious people do. And we need to continue. I could hear the strong emotions in the young lady who asked this question. I've realized how these moments, these conferences, even international law lectures, turn into a moment of collective grief. Because there is no other space in our societies to elaborate that grief. We need to accept that some of us deal with it by hiding themselves in denial, others feel enraged. But let's turn this feeling into something useful. And there are actions that can be taken to stop the system. You have already started. This country, and especially I was so impressed with what young Jewish Americans have done since October last year. I was here. I used to live here 10 years ago. So I was very familiar with the wonderful work of organizations like Jewish Voices for Peace. But still, as of October last year, I saw a new generation, and it's impressive. So join forces with those who are already working in this to change the system. Challenge your political representatives and also challenge the media. And this, in this country, the boycott, divest, and sanction movement it's almost, in some states, it's criminalized. This is not normal. The BDS is an act of protest. It's premised upon international law emanating from an ICJ advisory opinion. And this is what has led to the end, has contributed to lead to the end of apartheid in South Africa. Why it cannot be applied here? And even now, there are Israeli citizens asking for international pressure to lead to sanction. And I think that this is it.
You were just listening to Francesca Albanese, Anatomy of a Genocide, Gaza. She spoke at Georgetown University at the end of October. Francesca Albanese is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Naomi Klein, Ilan Pape, Norman Finkelstein, Chris Hedges, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Francesca Albanese, Anatomy of a Genocide, Gaza, and for the classic Edward Said book, Culture and Resistance, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.